Good afternoon, everyone. I see this is quite a big room. Can I be heard at the back? First of all, very warm thanks to Crash and the steering committee of the Humanitas professorship, Hans van der Ven and Susan Darivala, and also Adam Chow. And of course, big thanks to David Derwey Wang for his fascinating lectures, which have given us so much to think about and to talk about. Moyen's 2012 Nobel Prize set off a storm of controversy about his language. In his novels, to summarise very briefly and to overgeneralise, he writes a language of excess, which is notable for its manic mix of registers, for its graphic descriptions of gore and sex, for its eccentric analogies and metaphors, and for its hyperbolic dialogue. The books are scattered with magical realism. In the course of one work, for example, one protagonist generates a stream of urine some 15 metres long. Another character is welcomed home by dancing weasels in red vests and white shorts. China specialists, of course, have been debating Moyen's style for the past 30 years, ever since he became a leading representative of the post-Mao literary avant-garde. But although internationally reputed authors such as Kenzaburo Oe or Amy Tan have long endorsed Moyen's work, non-Sinophone literary critics rarely, if ever, engage with his novels in high-profile publications. The Nobel changed all that. Moyen's election to the canon of world literature generated a number of reviews by sharp non-sinologists, and several were disappointed by his linguistic indiscipline. Peter Kemp, the Sunday Times' veteran fiction expert, was puzzled by what he described as Moyen's, quote, crude eclecticism, unquote, by its garish hodgepodge of Rabelaisian earthiness and hallucinatory weirdness, bumpkin aphorisms, donkey droppings are shiny on the outside, a dead pig doesn't fear boiling water, and chaotic phantasmagoria. Nikhil Saval, in the London Review of Books, accused Moyen of lurid excess, of cramming his work with repetitive references to excretions, female body parts, violence, and out-of-control similes. Saval argued that, in his career-long refusal to shape or restrain his language, Moyen, quote, is in no danger of becoming anything other than a child, unquote. Now, it would be easy to counter these criticisms by arguing that the power of Moyen's prose is being lost in translation, that these reviewers would get Moyen if only they could access him in the original. But around the same time, Moyen's Sinophone critics also spoke out. In late 2012, Anna Sun and Perry Link both wrote essays expressing their dissatisfaction with Moyen's literary language. Moore's writing, said Sun, was diseased, a jumble of words that juxtaposes rural vernacular, clichéd socialist rhetoric, and literary affectation. It is broken, profane, appalling, and artificial. It is shockingly banal. Moore's grotesquerie, Perry Link argued, cheapened with a kind of daft hilarity the horrific 20th century events that Moore's historical novels fictionalise. There are fierce denigrators of Moyen's language within China too. In 2013, 40 mainland Chinese literary critics collaborated on a volume entitled Moyen Pipan, Criticisms of Moyen. They denounced Moyen for his lack of literary decorum, for his gratuitous depiction of violence, his explicit sex scenes, and his fixation on filth of many kinds. In China, the controversy over Moyen's language begins with his titles. After his novel Big Breasts and Wide Hips, Feng Ru Fei Tun, was first serialised in 1995, critics accused him of using vulgar sensationalism to draw readers. One complaint ran that the novel has contaminated society, poisoned minds, and harmed the reader with vulgar, obscene, dirty and ugly content. Moyen's writing, then, has offended Chinese reading critics both inside and outside China. Both groups have held Moyen up to the standards of literary propriety set by pre-1949 writing and found it wanting. Anna Sun, for example, lamented Moyen's rejection of China's long, great lyrical tradition. Perry Link compared Moyen's historical fiction unfavourably with Zhang Ailing's intricate short stories of wartime Shanghai. The authors of Moyen Pipan lambasted Moyen for flouting Lu Xun's severe prohibitions of subject matter too obscene for literary treatment, such as sex and excrement. What I want to do in this paper is to assess recent polemics about Moyen's narrative strategies. Can we find serious intellectual and aesthetic justifications for his linguistic grotesquerie? What does his stylistic excess tell us about the history of and challenges faced by 20th century Chinese literary language? For Moyen is not alone in reaching for an aesthetics of splatter and splurge. At least two of his contemporaries from the 1980s avant-garde, Yu Hua and Su Tong, have resorted to styles of comparably coarse overstatement in novels of Maoist and contemporary China, for example, in Brothers, Xiongdi, and The River Shore, He An. Their narratives are dominated by burlesque exaggeration, by violence, toilet humour, bodily fluids, expletives, and noisy sex. Full-body immersions in manure pits, cloacal voyeurism, orgies, self-castration, male breast implants, and beatings to death all are fairly commonplace occurrences. And this is not a literary choice resorted to one generation. A leading writer of the next generation, Zhu Wen, has also deliberately deployed vulgarity in his writing about 1980s and 1990s China. Moyen and his peers seem to have two literary aims in mind, one perhaps rather simplistic, the other more complex and subversive. First, there is a certain mimetic logic to this style. Justifying his own language of excess when describing Mao-era China, Su Tong has argued that these were violent, vulgar times. You have to use violent, vulgar language to describe them. Yu Hua has used similar reasoning to justify the extreme crassness of a book such as Brothers. His country, he's argued, is now so sick that a writer can't pretend to be a doctor. Instead, the best one can do is admit that one is ill and try to describe the symptoms. Similarly, Moyen's fiction often exposes the degradation of life in modern China, Maoism's abuse of peasants in Life and Death Are Wearing Me Out, Shengshe Pilao, or the gluttonous corruption of the market economy in Liquorland, Zhouguo. Purely on its own, though, this technique risks becoming a blunt literary device, the mimetic fallacy, by which authors represent a condition that too in language that too uncritically replicates the condition itself. But on another, more complicatedly dissident level, are Moyen and others also using linguistic excess to undermine or even explode the political controls of Mao-era communism? In high Bakhtinian style, Moyen's carnivalesque register subverts pious narratives about the perfection of post-1949 society. Through his devotion to indecorous language, characters, and situations, Moyen undermines the puritanical certainties of Maoist culture, jolting his readers into understanding the anarchic horror of modern China. This ambition clearly began with his breakout 1987 novel, Red Sorghum, Hong Gao Liang, a saga of the Sino-Japanese War that demolished Maoist stereotypes about saintly peasant patriots fighting Japanese invaders. The ambivalent, libidinous characters of Moore's gore and sex-filled story astonished readers brought up on squeaky clean revolutionary heroes and their struggles with imperialists and class enemies. Shelley Chan, who's the author of the only English language novel focused on Moyen, has argued that the chaotic strangeness of Moyen's style in fact liberates the writer from political strictures. There are no physical taboos. Any image can be put together, regardless of its discordance or peculiarity. Moyen himself describes the writing process as one of great freedom. He aims always to, quote, write like an ordinary person, unquote, to let the language pour out of him in an uncontrolled stream of consciousness. He's written, "My head is crammed full of these assorted memories, and I don't mean to write them down. They just flow out of their own accord." Moyen himself has stated that he aims to use his unmanicured vernacular to kick against the literary linguistic limits of high Maoist culture. Moyen's own background, the son of a poor peasant family from northeast China, motivates him to expose the untruths of socialist realism. As one of the rural millions who paid such a high price for Mao's state building plans, Moyen has been eager to reveal their brutal impact on China's peasants. While growing up, he at times went so hungry that he actually ate coal in desperation. The Shanghai literary critic, Chen Sihe, specifically admires this aspect of Moyen's writing. Chen has said, "He speaks like a peasant. He expresses their anger, their roughness. He has nothing of the intellectual about him." One of Moyen's peers, a writer from a well-known literary lineage, told me that the intensity of Moyen's anti-intellectualism can sometimes be unsettling. She said to me, "I sometimes feel that when he looks at me, he's thinking, what sort of creature are you? You know, 你是什么东西? Going back to critics like Anna Sun and Link, though, they're unconvinced that Moyen is attacking Maoist culture. Quite the opposite. Both feel that Moyen's unruly vernacular is evidence of a serious political disease at the heart of post-1949 Chinese literature. The strangulation of language by what they call, and what Professor Chen has already described very clearly, as Mao Wenti. In Sun's words, he describes this as the new literary language promoted by the socialist cultural bureaucracy. Crude, hyperbolic, affected, full of cliched political phrases. Link, Sun, and mainland critics like Li Tuo have argued that long after Mao's death, this language still traps later generations of writers within the political sensibility of the Maoist era. This is a language that was violently ruptured from China's pre-1949 literary heritage and makes it hard, if not impossible, for contemporary Chinese writers and readers to think outside the box of communist control of politics and culture. By Sun's and Link's reckoning, Moyen is imprisoned within Mao speak or Mao style. He's not satirizing or exposing it, but unquestioningly reproducing it, all the while skirting around its political taboos. Link illustrates his point with Moyen's descriptions of the economic utopianism of the Great Leap Forward and the famine that it generated. Link writes, "Moyen has great fun with the craziness, but leaves out the disaster of 30 plus million deaths by starvation. For actual readers, Moyen's giddy treatments of history divert attention from things that are hard to look at, but that still lurk in the culture at deeper levels. Escape of this kind may be welcome to some readers, perhaps most. In any case, it's certainly welcome to the regime." Now, I'm not about to defend every one of Moyen's linguistic choices to a critic as thoughtful and erudite as Perry Link. There is, for sure, sometimes an irritating sloppiness to Moyen's writing, bizarre, careless descriptions that obfuscate rather than illuminate. Since I first read the novel in 2014, I've been now puzzled, now bored, by the wayward and frequently repetitious descriptions of breasts in big breasts and wide hips. At one point, for example, the narrator is obliged to feel 120 sets of breasts in rapid succession in his professional capacity as an officiator of a local fertility cult. One pair, he records, cackled like stubborn hens. 他们像不驯妇的母鸡一样卡卡地叫着. Another resembled explosive quails with brown feathers, unyielding beaks, and short, powerful necks. 像性情暴力的鹌鹑，羽毛黄褐，嘴巴坚硬，脖子，足短有力. The last, in his Mama Marathon, he reports, was the warmest breast I'd ever felt, like a rooster with smallpox, so hot it nearly sparked. 他说我摸过的乳房里温度最高的，像生斗的公鸡一样，灼热炽炽的毛火星. Now, I'm not a vet, but I don't even know whether roosters get smallpox. I'd be very happy to have an answer about that. And sometimes one can't help the feeling that the anti-intellectual peasant writer Moyen is having a bit of a joke on us all. He pours out onto the page the first image that comes to his head and, hey presto, he wins a Nobel for it. But I'd also like to argue that this debate about the ethics of restraint in literary language is not unique to China. Indeed, this controversy is around as old as literary criticism itself. Consider Plato's anxiety to throw poets out of his republic because he was afraid of the disobedience they would incite among the populace. In the early 19th century, British literary critics feared for the way that impressionable female readers could be corrupted by the melodrama of the Gothic novel. Liang Qichao's Late Qing attack on traditional Chinese fiction expressed similar anxieties for readers of either gender. The whole argument resurfaced in post-1945 British writing, in ways at least partly analogous to the situation in post-Mao China. Prominent British authors such as Anthony Burgess, Angela Carter, and Martin Amis used stylistic flamboyance to revitalise the British novel after the austerity of the 1940s and 1950s. Critics quickly rounded upon them as garish, decadent, and wasteful of literary energy, accusing them of, quote, whipping up language to a frenzy for no particular reason, unquote. Martin Amis, in a way not dissimilar to Link's objection to Moyen's approach to historical events such as the famine of the 1960s, has been particularly criticised for writing in a tricksy, manic, comic satiric style about enormities such as the Holocaust, nuclear apocalypse, and sexual violence. Such treatment, one critic complained of Amis's Holocaust novel, Time's Arrow, was, quote, an insult to the memory of those who died in the concentration camps, unquote. Amis has rebutted his critics. He feels that he began writing in the late 20th century at a point when events of the past six decades or so had destroyed pre-existing moral certainties. As a result, he's written, all sorts of things are getting into the comic novel that shouldn't be there, like rapists and murderers. There's a kind of promiscuity of style, which is perhaps characteristic of the collapse of various structures in society and fiction. Amis sees his stylistic excess as educative, as forcing the reader to make ethical judgments, to fashion a new sense of literary propriety within a moral vacuum. He said, I don't feel that I'm shortchanging the reader by writing at my highest level of energy. Although I think it sometimes exhausts the reader. I think it's rather good to exhaust the reader. I don't mind. Do the readers good. Teach them. Amis believes that an interesting, complicated novel shouldn't allow the reader to identify too cozily with what's going on. Instead, it ought to confront the reader with making sense of different, unruly types of consciousness. And I wonder if Amis's ideal reader would also relish the educative challenge of Moyen's work. Admittedly, Moyen's oeuvre is marked by careless verbosity and stomach-churning excess. in his novel Sandalwood Death, Moyen includes page upon page of the most nauseating torture, a five-day execution by slow impaling, designed to shock readers into realisation of the sickness of modern China. For this reader, at least, the result was straightforward alienation. And I think if I hadn't been under commission to review the book, I probably would not have finished it. But sometimes, when Moyen spares his readers just a little, his violent, chaotic writing can be an effective and affective vehicle for evoking the horror of recent history, and particularly when he plays to his strengths, writing with sympathy and power about the persecution of the countryside under Maoism. Could you look at my handout now, which is a scene from Life and Death Are Wearing Me Out. Does everybody have a copy?
There are some roads that have none at all, so please share with your neighbors.
Has everybody who got one bit earlier managed to glance through it?
Who needs more? Raise your hand.
Hans, may I leave just a few seconds for people to read it? Thank you. You done, Hans? Okay. Now, as you'll see from this scene, an ox, who happens to be the reincarnation of a farmer unjustly executed during land reform in the 1950s, is tortured to death by a character called Shimen Jinlong, also the son of the executed character. And this torturing to death takes place across seven long pages in the original Chinese. He's tortured to death, this ox, for refusing to work on commune land. I think the scene is happening during one of the climactic points of the Cultural Revolution. And incidentally, and I think Professor Wang maybe agrees with me, I feel that this is one of the most successful of Moyen's several long historical novels about Maoist China. The premise alone is so wonderfully subversive. It's a novel about land reform told as a story of successive reincarnations. So this is the very epitome of the kind of feudal superstition that the communists were determined to abolish. Now, the passage that I've given you describes a level of violence quite normal for human protagonists in Moyen's book. But by focusing the brutality on an animal, albeit a reincarnation of a human, Moyen permits us just enough detachment to read on, while he instructs us in the cruelty of Mao-era society. My handout hopefully gives a sense of it in Howard Goldblatt's excellent translation, slightly tweaked by me to replicate the sentence rhythms of the original. The passage begins with the ox's nose being split by the strength with which the rope through the nose ring is being pulled by another ox. And through mimesis alone, sights, sounds, smells, Moyen's graphic account evokes the horror of the scene. But the language is also fast, furious, sometimes using rhythmic repetitions. The effect is to reinforce the sense of a mob situation spinning out of control. As the violence grows more frantic, so does the style, with seemingly involuntary exclamations from the narrator, so woohoo, simen yo, simen yo a. The Chinese for the fourth paragraph, beginning burn damn you, runs like this in a single sentence. We are shao si ni, jin long, ao jiao zhe, you wang yu mi, jie duo na bian pao qu, yi ran mei ren lan jie ta, ren men zun qing, yao jin long ba nie zuo da, lian jue wu heng gao, 一想教导人们要爱护集体财产的洪太岳也冷眼旁观，其实入了社的西门牛也是集体财产啊，牛是大家畜，是重要的生产资料啊。嗯，屠杀耕牛是严重的罪行，人们为什么忍着这罪行发生而不制止呢？ And here's the final passage in Chinese, which begins 8 lines from the bottom of the English, with the sentence, "You began to walk, how hard that must have been." 你艰难地往前走，四肢软弱，支撑不住身体，你的身体摇摇晃晃，你的被撕裂的鼻子滴着蓝色的血，黑色的血汇集到你的肚皮上，像凝着的焦油一样滴到地上。看热闹的群众都睁大了眼睛，张大了嘴巴，牛一步步地向我爹走去。牛走出了人民公社的土地，走进全中国唯一的单干户蓝莲那一亩六分地里，然后像一堵墙壁群众的群众的倒下了。西门牛死在我爹的土地上。These final phrases are from a purely technical point of view, riskily excessive. There is the extreme magical realism, the basic idea of an ox as a conscious, reincarnated being, capable of this grand gesture of defiance, the description of blue, then black blood. There's also the ring of empty cliché with the 看热闹的群众都睁大了眼睛，张大了嘴巴，没有声音。So the people gaped silently, wide-eyed and slack-jawed. But I think we can forgive it, because it is a fittingly stunning finale to the long, drawn-out violence, not only in its immediate visual impact, but also in its historic symbolism, evoking all the waste and suffering generated by Maoist collectivization. It's far from clear, to sum up, that Mo Yan's linguistic choices will filter through to subsequent generations, that they will become part of the heritage of the Chinese literary vernacular. The literary critic Chen Xiaoming believes that contemporary Chinese literature is currently too fragmented, too ruptured for generations born in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s to be influenced by Mo Yan's literary language. Chen Xiaoming says, literature goes through phase after phase successively. The next phase is something completely different. Writers born in the 70s and 80s belong to a different literary system. There's no way that the younger generation will study or imitate writers like Mo Yan, born in the 1950s, even though he has lots of readers, he's translated, and he wins the Nobel Prize. The generations are just too different. The critic and editor Li Jingzi backs up Chen's view. He says, every 3 years, China changes completely. It's no wonder that writers can't get a handle on it. But Mo Yan's language and the critical controversies surrounding it force us to grapple with some of the central dilemmas of the modern Chinese literary project. The creative possibilities and taboos of the literary vernacular in a century suffused with suffering, violence, and censorship. I don't necessarily agree with all of Mo Yan's solutions, but I find the questions that he raises compelling. Thank you.